Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome back our next guest, David Dye. David is the president of Let's Grow Leaders. He is the host of the Leadership Without Losing Your Soul podcast. He is the author of multiple books, and his next book, Powerful Phrases for Resolving Workplace Conflict, is available for purchase next week, May 14th, 2024, at all of your normal online and in-store locations. This work that he and his wife and business partner Karen put together is based on a global research study, which included over 5,000 participants from 46 different countries who shared how much conflict they're currently experiencing at work. Is it more or less than it used to be? What type of conflict are they experiencing? Who are they experiencing it with? How have they handled it well? Not so well. What are the reasons behind it? What have they learned? What would they do different? And so much more. And they combined all of these findings with input from other experts, their own experiences and research, to put the book together with the goal of arming people with a better understanding of how and why not only these conflicts happen, but how to handle them better and create stronger opportunities from them, but to also provide them with specific things to say and do in a wide range of situations with over 300 phrases that can be used and adapted every day in the workplace under the right situation. I'm really excited for David to share the takeaways from this book, including diving into the data, sharing this favorite of the 300 plus phrases that he has, sharing what he learned from some of the specific scenarios he ran into, talking about the four dimensions of handling conflict, navigating conflict, if you will, in the workplace, problems with I statements, and so much more. This episode, once again, is packed with great and very specific and actionable ideas from David's research and experience. I'm really excited to share it with you. But before we get into it, we want to take a few minutes, as always, to thank our sponsors. First, we have HumanTel. For everyone who has thought about how important it can be and the new opportunities it would unlock to be able to understand when people's emotions are shifting in real time by reading their facial expressions and nonverbal behavior, and then being able to adapt their conversations and approaches as a result, I highly recommend you head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off of all of their best-in-class training on exactly that. How do you understand what people are likely thinking and feeling in the moment by identifying how their emotions are changing based on their facial expressions and nonverbal communication? I vouch for the training myself. I've done it all. I highly recommend it. Please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their online training. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com for the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can learn all about the opportunities that members have access to, from online training and resources to in-person training events around the country and globally. That's also where you can find the networking opportunities, the supporting research, and yes, all the information about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. So if you feel like that designation is the next step for you in your career or for some of people on your team in their career, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com where you can learn more about what it takes to qualify for the exam, how to take the exam, and then what the designation can mean for you after passing the exam. All that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And please head over to inquasive.com. At inquasive.com is where you can learn more about the programs that we are asked to facilitate when our clients ask them to teach them the skills, perspectives, and techniques necessary to obtain sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences, whether that be in their leadership conversations, business development conversations, negotiations, hiring interviews, and so much more. All of that can be found over at inquasive.com. Thank you all very much for continuing to join us and listening to these conversations. I hope you're ready to take notes. Dave's got a bunch of great stuff to share. So without further ado, I introduce to you again, David Dye. Good afternoon, David. How are you?
I am fantastic, Michael. Good to be with you again.
It is great to be with you again. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. It is always a complete pleasure speaking with you. I learn so much every time. And today, I'm really excited to learn more because next week, your next book comes out. And in case anybody's listening and is not currently getting an eyeball full of what the cover of that book looks like, it is titled Powerful Phrases for Dealing with Workplace Conflict. And if I recall correctly, a lot of the material came from a global workplace survey that you conducted on navigating workplace conflict. Am I correct with that?
Yeah, that's right. We did the World Workplace Conflict and Collaboration Survey, which is still live if anybody wants to go participate and add your voice to it. But yeah, we surveyed over 5,000 people in 46 different countries.
Wow. I would say that's thorough.
Well, that was part of our goal. We really wanted to find out like what's happening now, because look, conflict's a part of human existence, right? A human experience. And it's, of course, it's going to be there at work, but what's different today than it was like 5 years ago. So that's why we wanted to do the survey and really draw out some of that.
That's awesome. So let's just jump in right there. If you don't mind, walk us through a two-part question. What did you find was different, and what were some of the best practices or new approaches you identified?
Yeah, I'll start with some of the questions that we asked. So we wanted to find out, like, over the past couple of years, are you experiencing more or less or the same amount of conflict at work? And the answer there is 70% of folks, and again, good representative sample, and we looked, broke it out by countries and everything else, but 70% of folks said, I'm experiencing the same or more conflict at work as I have before. And then we had 30% of folks say, you know, I'm experiencing less. And we said, oh, that's interesting. So let's dive in and tease out that data. And it turns out that half of those folks, the reason they're experiencing less is not for the best reasons. Basically, it's because they left the job and they like, I had to go somewhere else. So they ran away from the conflict. No complaint for them, but that's not a positive outcome for the place they left, right? And then there's a, you know, a good portion of folks that were saying, you know, I'm working from home now, so I'm just not around people. I'm not having those interactions and that kind of thing. And so you've got a number of those kinds of situations where they're experiencing less conflict, but not always for reasons that mean there is less conflict. It's just they've escaped it.
And thank you for breaking that down, because for me, one of my biases, anytime somebody starts quoting numbers research, is please share the context of the situation. Don't tell me that 30% of the people are experiencing less conflict and then manipulate that number to try to serve some other goal that we're trying to achieve. And I know you weren't doing that in any way, but I feel like we get that a lot. Somebody does a survey or gets some data and then presents this cool number, which I'm not questioning the veracity of the number, but I would love to know the context of where it came from to begin to determine the true value. So I'm thrilled to hear that you went that deep.
I definitely have a bent that way. Karen and I both do. My first week of work, I'm talking like in my early 20s, my first salary job, the very first all hands meeting I show up to, there's a guy presenting some data, some survey work they had done in the organization and so forth. And here I am. It's literally my second day on the job. Hand in the air. Hey, can you break that number down for me? It's just, you know, I'm with you on that. Like, I want to know, you know,
yeah,
what's going on. And everybody's looking at me like, who the heck is this guy? I hadn't quite learned how to navigate workplace politics quite yet, but.
Well, now you can tell us what you learned in your survey, and you can tie it in. But that, I mean, context is so important. I'm not saying in any survey the number's wrong, but let's figure out what it really means so we can put it to the proper use and take the proper lessons from it.
Exactly. Absolutely. So that was a top level question we asked about, you know, where are the trends going and more or less and that kind of thing. And why, and what are the contributing factors? And so, you know, we did that qualitatively and then broke it down into the initial sample, then broke that down to what are the contributing factors, and then built a drop-down list and let people choose up to three of those going forward. And three or four of the most contributory reasons were overwhelm, burnout, understaffing, right? So you've got all of that coming up from after the pandemic, which continues to linger. Tied with poor management practices. And as you know, we're all about leadership management here. So we get down on our managers, like, oh, and poor management practices. Managers are dealing with a lot today, and this is contextual to today. And when you tease again, get into the data, look at the answers, look at what's going on, managers are facing a really challenging situation lately where you've got new trends in the workplace that they're not necessarily trained in how to deal with. hybrid, remote, you've got increasing needs of the workforce for empathy, vulnerability, support, and which are all good. And we're all about human-centered leadership here. So those are good, but they also present new challenges to managers. And then you've got the complexity of the workplace today with, especially post-pandemic, with hybrid remote work, with, it's not unusual to have teams that are across multiple different time zones or geographies. And all of that makes your manager's job much more challenging. And so you're seeing this in like the Gallup data that for the first time in history, the disengagement level of managers is higher than that of the general workforce, which is concerning and shocking. So when we're talking about poor management practices and overwhelmed burnout, those top two were tied in terms of contribution to increase in workplace conflict. After that, followed by you've got pandemic-related mental health, anxiety. Some of those challenges continue to linger. And then they have less motivated workforce. And I like to say after a global staring contest with mortality changes people's priorities and dynamics. And they're like, okay, what am I doing here? Was this really what I want to be doing? All that kind of thing. And then with the polarization in the world today, you also have a sense of less tolerance and understanding for one another. And that's fueled by all the things we hear about social media. And I mean, you can't wake up and read the news without it trying to fire you up about something. The 10 things that you must know about zucchini and what's wrong with you if you don't, that kind of thing. So it's like everything's kind of made to fire us up. So there's a lot of those contributing factors that that we saw come out in the survey there.
So now I'm getting angry at zucchini. So thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. So everything you said, as I listened to you go through it, like, that makes sense. That makes sense. That makes sense. That makes sense. When you think about how the dynamics really of society and therefore, of course, in the workplace have changed over the last 5 years or so. So I'm curious, looking at that data, what were some of the best techniques you found for navigating these new contexts or new contextual elements that maybe weren't as prevalent or present prior to the last 5 years?
It's interesting. One of the other, so that's kind of the first set of questions we asked. The second set of questions we asked, we were very qualitative. We said, hey, tell us about one of your biggest workplace conflicts. Just describe what happened. Tell us about it. And they were all over the place, everything you can imagine, and some really, really sad ones. And then we said, if you could go back and give your former self some advice, what would that be? And this isn't necessarily new, but the preponderance of the advice was fascinating. 55% of people said that if I could go back and give myself some advice, it would be patient and stay calm. I'm like, wow. I mean, it's not even close. 2-1 over the second place, which 21% of people said I would go back and tell myself, talk about it, have the conversation, address it directly, and do that sooner or at all in many cases.
Yeah.
And so that's 76% of people, and that's over 3/4 of the people surveyed said, what's your advice to yourself? I need to be calm and I need to talk about it. Right. Okay. So, all right. So there you go. The question is, and this is where we had to do, and this is where we then pick up and start doing the work, is how do you do that?
Yes.
How do you stay calm? How do you remain patient? How do you address it directly? And so we have 4 dimensions of collaboration that if you invest in these upfront, they reduce the preponderance of destructive conflict. And as you're engaging in conflict, if you'll invest in these 4 things, they will help make it productive conflict. And so I know this is not going to be a surprise to you, Michael, but like one of the things that I like to stress when we're talking about workplace conflict can be destructive or can be positive, right? We don't want the destructive stuff where we're like destroying people's, sense of, what's the word I'm looking for? Dignity, right? We don't want to be doing that. But constructive conflict, or if we call it collaboration, that's like building new things, creating new ideas, solving interesting problems. And we want to be doing that.
For sure. And I'm going to come back and ask you about those four dimensions because I can't just let that hang there. So we're going to have to come back and talk about that. But you're 100% right. And it is true, like tried and true is what I was going to say, that stay patient, let the conversation come to you, let the opportunity come to you, listen to what they have to say. You never know, you might learn something. Stay calm. And then, yeah, have the conversation. Maybe not immediately when we're the most upset, but soon. Like not walk away and let it linger forever. Because I'm imagining for most of us, you know, I can use the analogy of going to the gym. If I miss a day because I didn't feel well or I was traveling or my son had a baseball game or whatever, I'm probably likely to go back the next day if I've been in a routine, which for the record, I'm not right now. But if I miss a week, now it's harder to go back. If I miss 2 weeks, yeah, I might not go back. And if I miss a month, I'm going to change my route to work so I don't have to drive by it anymore and remind myself that I'm not going. And the same thing I feel like, and please correct me, is true with conflict. Like there's too soon, I probably don't want to make it worse, pour fuel on the fire. Okay, maybe. But then there's that helpful window where either I go back and address it now, or the longer I wait to address it, the harder it becomes to address.
Yeah, and I think that's true of so many things in life, right? Of like whether it's the gym or a tough assignment that you're dealing with. Like I in my career, I built a rule for myself that I found particularly in a leadership role. As soon as I started feeling that sense of avoidance, like I'd be looking at my to-do list and different projects, different conversations, whatever it was. And you know, there's that one you look at it and you go, and I want to just skip through that one and go to something else. I discovered that whatever provoked that response in me was the most important thing I could possibly do. Mm-hmm. Tackle that first. Why? Because exactly as you say, the longer I let that linger, the bigger it becomes in my psyche and the harder it is to go and tackle it. Whereas if I just deal with it as soon as I feel that, boom, it's dealt with. I'm stronger. I feel more confidence in my own abilities, and that becomes easier the next time. And when conflict conversations, like you're talking about, the more we do it and the better we get at it, the easier it is to do it faster. So you're saying, you know, I don't necessarily want to do this right this minute and add fuel to the fire. Well, the more skillful you become, the less fuel you're adding and the more productive conversation you can have.
And everything we do gets better with reps. Everything.
Unavoidable.
So let me make my mistakes and let me be uncomfortable. Let me stumble through it. But the more I do it, the better we'll get. I am curious, as you were talking about how to do these things, how to stay patient, how to stay calm, how to be more in a learning mentality, have the conversation faster. To what degree was there any education, any feedback, any learning on either maintaining focus on an outcome or a future state in order to help create the state of mind necessary to navigate conflict more successfully?
Yeah, that really gets into those four dimensions that we were talking about. So I'll just throw them out here and they'll provide some scaffolding for our conversation. But so the four elements, the four dimensions of collaboration and conflict that we look at are connection. So how well do we know one another as human beings? The more of that we have, the easier everything else becomes. Clarity. Do we have a shared understanding of success and what success looks like? And that gets to some of what you're talking about in terms of outcomes. Curiosity. Are we genuinely open to alternative perspectives, different paths, and looking at the possibilities? And this, again, goes to a sense of outcomes. And we'll talk about some of the specific phrases we can use to get there.
Nice.
And then finally, commitment. And this is one a lot of people leave off, but is, do we have a shared agreement of what we're doing next and a way to hold ourselves accountable for that? Which makes, you know, all of that nice conversation we had to work something out mean something if we take action on it. So those four elements of connection, clarity, curiosity, and commitment, the more we invest in those up front, the less destructive conflict, the less heated, the less fiery it gets, and the more collaborative, the more better problem solving we can do down the road. So it's something we can use those four dimensions before, and we can use them in the middle of any kind of conflict we're having.
Fantastic. So with those, I guess if we can take a couple minutes, and I don't want to take I know the book comes out next week and I can't wait to read it. So I don't want to take too much from the book, but to the degree that you're comfortable as we start working towards some of these phrases that really caught your attention and you found the power in, if we can talk just a little bit about because I think the four of those dimensions make sense, but applying connection, clarity, curiosity, and commitment.
Yeah, let's do it. And hey, listen, Michael, there are over 300 phrases in the book, so there's no way we're going to like knock those out to where. No, what I do want to share a couple that I think will whet people's appetite. And we like to say, you know, people ask, how do you use this book? And we'd recommend read the first couple chapters. You read the first 5-6 chapters and you get a foundation for dealing with any kind of conflict you're going to encounter. And that includes what we call the GOATs. So greatest of all time, powerful phrases. I mean, we have actual goats in the book. So I'm talking like legit. I've got a lion over my shoulder for folks who are watching, but we got actual goats representing. And these greatest of all time, these are 12 powerful phrases that you can use in a variety of different situations. So you were asking some of my favorites. Let's just talk about connection for a second. How building that connection when you're talking about a conflict kind of a situation, like just starting with a statement of connection, like, hey, listen, I care about you. I care about this project. I'm confident we can find a solution we can all work with, right? Connecting to the other person, connecting to their interests. Do you have their best interests at heart genuinely? And there's a lot of different kinds of phrases that you can use to do that. Just asking somebody, tell me more, whatever it is that they're talking about, whatever they're saying, putting a zip in your own lip and just saying, you know what? Tell me more. That's a connecting phrase because it communicates that you genuinely want to hear. You're not just trying to talk. You're not just trying to get your own perspective in there, but you're genuinely listening until they've explored it to the extent they can. So those there's just a couple of examples of some of those kind of connecting types of phrases. And actually, Michael, you are in the book. We have a whole series of expert insights throughout the book that we're talking about different people like yourself with your own expertise and pulling some of yours in. So I liked one of yours as a connecting phrase of, if I recall, it was when we're dealing with conflicting goals. You've got a goal, I've got a goal, but they're in opposition to each other, but we're relying on each other to be successful. What the heck do we do now? And I love your opening phrase was, well, this sucks. creating rapport, creating that connection, like just acknowledging the situation. And then as you talk through it, one of yours was on that, continuing that conversation was, you know, reasonably speaking, what's the soonest or the longest or whatever the situation is that would work for you, that you could see this happening? What's the fastest we could do this that would work for you? And, you know, exploring the connection, the possibilities that way. I thought that was a good example of where connection and curiosity come together. So those are some connection ones. Another one that goes, I'm going to mention that you were talking about outcomes earlier and how important it is to get to that sense of outcomes. So when we talk about clarity, one of the biggest sources of workplace conflict is we are not on the same page. We're not working towards the same objectives, or we have different understandings of what's supposed to be happening. So one of my very favorites that gets to this, goat number four, what would a successful outcome do for you? So it's not, what does success look like for you? Because that gets us in our like, well, I need this to happen, so forth. No, it's what would that do for you? What's the thing you're actually trying to achieve? And the more that I know about that, the more I can start to craft some kind of solutions, or we can work together to craft some solutions that are going to help us both achieve what those outcomes would do for us. So it's what's behind whatever it is that we're immediately asking for. So those are a couple just to get us started. There are obviously a bunch more, but we can pause there.
I'm not good at math, but I think there's 299 more, give or take.
Give or take.
First, thank you for being very flexible on your definition of expert and expertise. I appreciate that. It's an honor to be a part of your book, and I appreciate being the wild card or the exception or however it worked. But that last example you gave, I don't know if people truly or immediately understand the significance in the difference in those two questions. I think for a lot of people, if they're busy, if they're not thinking, if they're going through like their script or whatever they were told to do, well, I want you to know I care about you and I want to do something positive for you. So I'm going to ask, what does success look like for you? But to your point, that forces me to take a position. And now once I take that position, that's what I want. Mm-hmm. And now it puts me, or gives, I'm going to use the word position again, whatever. Clearly I don't speak English very well, but now it puts me in the position to defend that, to ask for it, to demand it, to fall back on it. Now we get into this push, pull, give, take, reject and retreat conversation that we want to stay out of. But if you ask, what will success do for you? Now the do for you, well, that would allow me to, that would make me feel. That would set up. That allows the next step to start. Cool. Now we can achieve that and we can come up with a new way to do it because we have the outcome to focus on and build. And the position that here I've staked myself to isn't what I need now. It is the outcome that that need will generate. So it creates the collaboration and the flexibility in the conversation. So goat number four is a goat for sure.
And there's just, you know, there's like so many different applications of it and where we can get ourselves stuck. And I'm just thinking of an easy example. We're heading this weekend, we're heading to a conference and Karen and I have responsibility. Karen's my partner for listeners in work and life. But anyway, we've got responsibility for this conference. And one of the guys who has a role to play, sales guy, and he's traveling the whole week before, and then he's going to show up at the conference. Well, he set out on his week junket before the thing, and he forgot a critical piece of equipment that needs to be there that he was supposed to bring with him. Because he was leaving a week early, he forgot it. So he writes us and says, hey guys, can you bring this? Well, we immediately go, okay, that's the position, right? How do we bring this? That's not actually what the successful outcome would do. A successful outcome would do for him would mean that the equipment he needs is at the venue. It doesn't matter who brings it. Doesn't matter how it gets there, right? So that immediately opens us up. Instead of the first conversation we have is, well, gosh, can we check that with the other stuff that we've got and everything else? And then we're going to have to pay that money. And or do I even have the case that you can check that in? I don't know if I have that. Where do we get that, right? All of that kind of stuff was the first conversation. The second conversation is, this isn't what we're trying to do. What would a successful outcome do? It would have the equipment on site. How else can we do that? One phone call to somebody in that city. Oh yeah, I got somebody who can do that. We'll have it there for you.
Yeah.
You know, so it's that question is just, what would a successful outcome do for you? It's so, so powerful.
What's the real problem we're trying to solve?
Yeah. And so often people don't lead with that, you know, and they've got an agenda that they're trying to maximize, minimize, solve for themselves. And if we can get to that, then we're in a position to have a real conversation.
And if we can stay patient and remain calm and breathe in a manner that allows enough blood and oxygen to remain in our brain to make good decisions and make good observations, now we can start parsing this out in the middle of a conversation and not falling hostage to somebody else's word choice, demeanor, behavior, tone.
Exactly. I want to go to goat number seven, because I think that this is one that I have found helps me do what you were talking about. The breathing, the actually listening, getting out of my, you know, that whole, like, how do we get out of that amygdala hijack of I'm under threat? I'm, you know, so when I'm there, like, I can't do anything else. And one of the best ways that I have found to get out of it, because by the way, like Karen and I have to practice this stuff. We can't be writing a book about this and put it out of the world if we're not dealing. We're married, we co-own a business and doing work together. Like we just got back traveling internationally for 2 weeks. You bet there's some conflict, right? So how are we doing this? Well, when I get fired up, but what I've found is one of the best questions I can ask is goat number seven, which is, I'm curious how this looks from your perspective. Right. And find your own wording, right? That works for you. But I have used those exact words a couple of times when I am finding myself really lit up about something. You know, I'm curious, how does, and I, you know, I can drop the I'm curious part in certain conversations. Like, how does this look from your perspective? As soon as I do that, two things happen. One is it takes me out of my amygdala, because now real curiosity is a frontal cortex type of thing in our brain. So it automatically drops some of all of the raging, and I don't know all the biology behind it, right? But all of those hormones and whatever's firing immediately drops some of that. I'm now in my front brain going, okay, well, how does this look from your perspective? Triggers some of the empathy stuff. And the second thing that happens is I get a perspective I didn't have before. And it blows my mind when I have asked this question. I have been really intentional about trying to ask this question in different circumstances, different people. Blows my mind what I learn and what this thing looks like from their perspective. And maybe some of the insecurities they're dealing with or some of the fears that they have that weren't even on my radar. But I wouldn't even like, why would you feel that way? You got no reason to feel scared about anything, right? Oh, you're feeling scared? Whoa. Okay. Different conversation, you know? It's amazing what we can learn when we ask a question like that.
So I'm digging this goat conversation. I'm not going to ask you for all 12. They should go get the book and they should read all 12, but we got two. So if you were going to pick a couple of more that you have just found tremendous success and application across contexts, what are a few more that people can start applying today to start reaping these benefits?
The first one, I'm going to choose a clarity one. I'm going to choose a commitment one because so often in our we've done a connection, we've done a curiosity. So we did that one clarity one about what would a successful outcome do for you. But let me choose one more clarity, which is, I call this a check for understanding, but it's making sure we're on the same page, that we're actually hearing each other the same way. And so it's just saying something like, hey, what I'm hearing you say is that you need this so that you can feel good about with your boss and look good to your boss. Do I have that right? Like, I'm clarifying what I think I heard you say in my own words. So you can say, yeah, that's exactly what I'm after. Or you can say, no, that's not it at all. What I really need is this, right? So we can make sure we're on the same page. It is remarkable to me in human communication when we skip that, how often we are operating on totally different pages, like not even the same ballpark. And then this is goat number 12, which is one of my, another all-time favorite. I call this schedule to finish. What this means is we don't walk away from the conversation without a specific commitment to follow up in some way. And so I might say something like, hey, let's schedule time to talk about this again and see how our solution's working. And so this is that commitment I was talking about earlier. Like, I like to say nothing changes if nothing changes. So, right, we have to do something in order for there to be a different outcome. So how do we ensure that happens? Well, let's say you and I are having a conversation back to our competing goals thing, and we work out a solution. So what I hear you saying, Michael, is you want to try this and you can live with it if we can get it done this fast. I think I can do that too. All right. So are we saying the same thing? Are we agreed we're going to be able to, let's try to get this done by next Friday. Does it sound good? And you say, yeah, okay, that's good. All right, we're on the same page. Check it out. Let's get together Monday morning, the following Monday. Are you free at 8 right before everything kicks off and starts? And you say, yeah, I'm good. Great. Let's get together for just 10 minutes, put it on our calendars right now, and let's you and I meet and see how it went. And when we do that, several things happen. One, it reality tests our agreement because now we just said, we're committing on Monday, we're going to meet. Oh, shoot. Can I actually do that? Is that actually going to work? It forces me to think through bandwidth, competing priorities, what else is going on? You're thinking about that too. Right. So we have to reality test whatever agreement we're making and make sure that it'll work. And if it doesn't, we go, oh, you know what? Actually, no, that's not going to work. And here's why. Now we can explore other possibilities. Second thing it does for us, raises the likelihood that we're going to follow through on whatever commitment we made because we just built in, I'm going to look eyeball to eyeball with you, whether it's virtual eyeball or physical eyeball. And we're going to have that conversation. So it increases the likelihood that we're both going to follow through on the commitment we made. And that builds confidence, that builds trust, builds follow through, all that kind of thing. And then the third benefit to this one, this is a three for goat. Like you get all these benefits from one phrase. The third benefit is that it gives us a chance to handle exceptions. So what do I mean by that? In good faith, you and I say, this is what we're going to do. And then our manager swoops in with a fire drill or a customer demand or whatever happens and poof, blows it all up. And we got no time to deal with the thing we said we were going to do. Well, if we don't address that, we made a commitment to each other that we didn't keep. And if we don't talk about it, trust erodes. But if we have a built-in time on our calendar where we're getting together to talk about it, now we can say, oh, Michael, that thing we said we were going to do, we didn't do it, did we? And you're like, nope. Well, that sucks. All right. Well, what happened? Oh, shoot. Yeah, our boss came in. We had that fire drill, that customer demand. Okay, that blew up. All right. What are we going to do now? How can we recommit? Let's try that again. Or can we come up with a different solution that's going to work even in the case of, you know, those kinds of things? So it gives us a chance to handle those exceptions. So that's an incredibly powerful one. Let's schedule time to talk about this and see how it's going.
Again, not only do I love it, but a couple of small pieces that hopefully people are catching here. When you we're talking, whatever day this week we're talking, Wednesday, and we're going to get back together next Friday. We're going to say it's done. We're not waiting till Thursday to get back together. And that seems like an obvious thing. Like, okay, get it done next Friday. Well, let's check Thursday where we're at. No. Like, how many times had, and this is obviously a rhetorical question, how many times has conflict arisen because we didn't leave the runway to resolve it? So now we have deadline pressure. We have violation of expectations. We have all these other things that are happening that are causing us to get upset and derail the conversation. If we just had this conversation on Monday, it probably wouldn't have been an issue. So leaving that runway is a big one. And also that piece about the checking the expectations. I remember giving a presentation a couple years ago now to one of these CEO, like peer-to-peer groups. And the guy who was in charge of the group was talking about how they all work really hard to hire leaders in their organizations at a certain level. Mm-hmm. And that if somebody, you know, can't make a deadline or can't make a commitment, then they clearly don't have the value it takes and they need to be moved out of the organization. And like you raising your hand in your second day at work, we haven't even finished dinner yet. And I'm like, dude, let's take about 47 steps back. Maybe he doesn't have the value system and maybe he doesn't belong in your organization. That option is on the table. But before we get to that option, can we please raise our contextual awareness and start working backwards through another series of more likely options with varying degrees of acceptability and plausibility to figure out what's really going on here? To number one, address whatever the issue is now, let's solve that problem, and then determine, can we do that in a way that ensures future problems don't repeat themselves, and we have somebody we can build on in the organization as opposed to write them off. And as we all get lost in our own talk tracks, it's really easy to make ourselves feel better by writing somebody else off, and that can be a huge mistake.
Huge mistake. And so often, and one of the reasons that I love so many of these conversations that we've got in the book is because they help you get down to the structural things, the system things, the, as you've said in one of our other conversations, the glitch in the matrix, right? That the things that are causing some of that to happen. And you know, going back to just this last goat I was mentioning of, hey, let's schedule a time to follow up on this, right? There are things that happen and that come up and that, you know, that we didn't anticipate or couldn't deal with, and it forces us to have some of those conversations. You know, so many people will say yes because they want to be a team player. Well, that's not being a team player, because if you say yes to everything, you're actually saying, I'm going to drop some balls. Just none of us know which ones those are going to be.
We'll figure it out.
So let's have that conversation on the front end and look at what that actually looks like.
And if we don't ask the right question to the point of people saying yes, we end up getting implied expected answers. If I ask you the question in a way where you feel like the only right answer is yes, then you're going to say yes. And it's going to be quick and you're going to look confident, because it's not that you can do it, it's you figured out the answer to the test. And then afterwards, you're going to walk away. Maybe it falls through or it doesn't happen. And then I feel like you lied to me. You were disingenuous. You're not committed. You know, all of these things. When no, actually, I asked a horrible question, which then produced a reflexive, unhelpful answer, which then generated a suboptimal outcome, which I'm now pinning on you, because why would I look myself in the mirror and take responsibility for that? So put like backtracking, reverse engineering the process, asking some of these GOAT questions and better questions helps people save face, open up, feel vulnerable, and navigate conflict that might not even happen this time.
Exactly. So these are these are examples of, you know, if I hope you read the whole book or at least find the chapter that really deals with your specific situation. And we've got a ton of different scenarios in there where we get specific. But those kinds of questions, they really are cross-applicable in so many different situations.
It certainly sounds like it. So we've got four. We'll learn the rest when we read the book. You talk about the specific situations that you have. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming with 301 questions, you've probably got at least 152 different scenarios. So again, not asking you to go through all of them, but as you look through the work that was completed as you were completing the survey and putting the book together, are there one or two scenarios that seemed most common within the research that many of our listeners can likely relate to and start learning from?
Yeah. And another way I'm going to phrase that is, what are some of the most popular? Yeah. So, yeah. And a couple of those are dealing with overwhelm, like, mm-hmm. you know, and it's so common, like when you feel overwhelmed, what to say when you feel overwhelmed. So there's a whole section of different tricky workplace scenarios. So what to say when you feel overwhelmed? What do you say when you need to say no, even to your boss? Like, there's powerful phrases to help with that. Let's say that your team lacks accountability and you're frustrated by that. Conversations you can have there, right? So those are examples of like tricky workplace scenarios. Several, I don't know, maybe eight different scenarios dealing specifically with your boss and different difficult situations there. You got a micromanager. Your boss is taking credit for your ideas. That's another one that always gets
happens.
I know it happens, right? Or if you've got a moody boss, a screamer, they're dropping F-bombs, stuff like that. Or someone who's giving you really lazy or vague feedback, that's another common one. So some different kinds of scenarios like that. And then, you know, dealing with coworkers, chronic complainers, passive-aggressive coworkers, lazy coworkers, know-it-alls, all those good things. So those are just a couple of examples, but lots of different scenarios that we get into specifics on.
Nice. I'm listening to you go down the list, and in my mind, I'm seeing listeners go, yep.
Unfortunately, but yes, that is the reality.
Let's, if you don't mind, let's circle back to the saying no.
Okay.
I feel that one is ubiquitous and tricky. Because to your point earlier, sometimes it's important to say no. Like saying yes is only going to make the situation worse long term, but we don't want to make our situation worse now or not appear like a team player. We don't want to be insubordinate. We don't want to appear disrespectful. So when it comes to saying no, what were some of the great phrases that you uncovered to say no and still keep the relationship or your reputation intact?
And it's, you're absolutely right. And if we go back to the dimensions, right, of connection, when we're saying no, we want to actually start with saying yes.
Thank you.
And we're saying yes to the person. We're saying yes to the relationship. Maybe we're saying yes to the value of their idea. I may not be able to participate in that right now, but I still can validate our relationship or the thing or whatever. So that's kind of a way to just mentally set when I need to say no is I start by acknowledging and connecting. And so what does that look like? So, you know, maybe I'm saying, wow, I'm impressed by everything that you're doing here on this project. It looks amazing. I can't help with it right now. And I think it's amazing what you're doing, right? So I'm validating what they're doing. It's not that it's not important. I can't be a part of it. Sometimes, and it's important to remember for some folks, no is a complete sentence in many situations, and it's not that you always have to justify it the way that sometimes you feel. But if you're talking to your manager, then we've got a different situation. Yeah. So let's up the ante. So I'm going to take just another coworker type of situation because it's a common one. People have too many meetings, right?
Really?
Oh my gosh, my calendar is filled with meetings. I got to get out of some of these meetings. I need to say no to some meetings. How do I do that? What's the contribution you need me to make for that meeting? What's the successful outcome going to do for you? Right? What's that look like? Great. I will get it to you in an email before the end of the day. Or can I just show up for that section, for that 20 minutes of the agenda? You're right. It would make sense to spend that time with the team. Can I just show up for that? Right? So you know, different ways to say yes to what's necessary, but no to the whole thing that's sucking the time away, right? All right. So let's say that your boss is asking for something. How do we say no to that? Again, we start by saying yes. So I might start with, hey, listen, I am deeply committed to the success of the team and to this project. So what you're asking me to do here would mean doing this, doing that, which means not doing this and not doing that, or this deadline would slip. That concerns me because we've talked about this needs to happen by such and such. I'm thinking another approach might be this. How does it look from your perspective? So now I'm piecing together several of these phrases and together, but that's the way I might approach that from a connection standpoint. Another way to do it, if you know, somebody's asking about it, you slotting into a specific kind of a project or something like this, is you might start again acknowledging the positive. Like, I always want to grow and I want to contribute everything I can to the company. And I don't think I'm the best fit for what you're asking for the role that you're suggesting, because I'm curious how you see it. You know, so explain myself, invite their perspective. If you are yourself overwhelmed and your boss is asking for yet another thing, being upfront about it. And it's one of the most powerful things you can do is to say, you know, I've got these five priorities, which are due in this sequence. And the project you're talking about sounds exciting. And actually, I'd love to be a part of it. And I can't take that on, not right now, without reprioritizing some of these other things. You know, at our next one-on-one, can we talk about what that could look like? Because I am interested, but I can't say yes in good conscience with these things. So I'd love to have that conversation. So there's just some ways to do that.
Yeah. And a little piece in there that you did far more often than not is you replaced but with and. So it's one of those things, I'm sure you've heard it. I forget where I heard it. This was absolutely not my phrase. So I'm going to admit to stealing it, but unfortunately I can't confess who I stole it from at this point because it's been so long. But is the magic eraser.
Yeah.
That's a great idea, but
what?
I'd really like to do that, but I sure wish I could help you, but it invalidates what comes before. So now if it's, that's a great idea, and I can't wait to contribute once these other five priorities have been taken care of. Bam. So hearing you do that, and it was for me, and I'm an observation nerd, right? But picking up on even the little hesitation around like the it wasn't a full stop, wasn't a full pause, but the and was like just enough to keep the conversation going and avoid falling into that trap. And again, and I would love your input on this, a lot of navigating conflict and creating true collaboration is not avoiding the topic. It's not avoiding the issue. It's not even avoiding sensitive areas. It's having enough foresight and being strategic enough in the communication where we don't create unnecessary, unhealthy emotional responses.
Exactly.
Where a misplaced word or a misplaced gesture sets somebody off, where flip that, those two words, or maybe replace one word, this doesn't happen. And if we're not patient, and if we're not calm, and if we're not focusing on the outcome, then it's just not going to happen.
You know, as you're talking, there is another category of no, and that is the one that's ethics or values clashes or integrity mm-hmm. types of things. And again, there's language to do that. You know, nope, can't do that. That's clearly a violation of our code of conduct. I am not comfortable with that. That doesn't feel right to me. This isn't sitting right with them. Can we call HR? Can we call compliance and check this out? Because I'm not sure, right? And so inviting the conversation, that sort of thing. In contrast, and actually this was a great moment of learning for me. Very early in my career, I was working in a company. The CEO was putting on this marketing event and wanted me to be a part of it. And it did not sit right with me. Like integrity-wise, I'm like, I'm not comfortable with this. Of course, I didn't say anything because CEO, right? So, and for 3 days, like I was not sleeping well. I'm like, how can this guy be so, you know, and I'm like all the stories in my head and why he's such an idiot and, you know, unethical and everything else. And finally, after like 3 days of stewing like that and not sleep, I finally couldn't stand it anymore. And I didn't use any of these powerful phrases because I didn't have them that early. I just kind of popped my cork and I was like, I can't be a part of this. This lacks integrity. You know, and I was very inelegant. What happened next? What do you think he said?
Well, the story goes one of two ways. Either it was surprisingly positive because he caught his attention and you caused him to think differently, or he told you exactly why you were going to do what he wanted you to do because it's his company and he's in charge.
I know. I love sharing that. I'll get to the story and I'll share that with an audience and then say, what do you think he said? You know, you're fired, right? Or which is a possibility, like do it or else, you know, like you don't like it. There's the door, any of that kind of stuff. That's the stories that, you know, you have in your head. I was ready to get fired. What actually happened was such a cool learning moment for me. He said, David, I don't see it that way. I don't think it lacks integrity at all. But I don't want you to violate your conscience. And then he asked me a really important question that I had not thought about. How can we make this something you feel good about? Oh, I had not thought about that. And it turned out there was an easy answer. I'm like, how about we tell the people coming to the event that this aspect of it is the case, and then they'll know, and I'll feel good, and they'll feel good, and it all works. He said, yeah, we can do that. How much time and energy did I waste stewing when, you know, and kudos to him for teaching me, like, if you don't say anything, sometimes your silence is selfish. By not saying anything, I was depriving him of the chance to make a different choice. And he could have made the same choice. He could have said, nope, I don't see it your way. Sorry. There's the door. He could have said that. But by saying something, I gave him the chance to make a different choice. And if nothing changes, nothing changes. And so that's that for me, it was a huge learning moment about the power of saying something and having the conversation and doing that elegantly and using the phrases we share with you in the book gives people a chance to have a much more positive, powerful outcome than if you don't say anything.
Sure does. And to that point, even if you get it wrong, like, if you could tell your older self, does this question sound familiar? If you could tell your older self how to handle that better, you'd have a dozen different options. But even in doing it in a way that you wouldn't coach to do it anymore,
right,
you still were able to get to a positive outcome. And I'm willing to bet that for whatever frustration or anger or disappointment he might have felt while you were speaking to him that way in his office, in his building, the end result likely led to a more positive feeling between the two of you after he asked the question, you responded in kind, you ended up on a shared good idea and took action in it. Now you have this common experience to bond over, and believe it or not, I would bet the relationship was likely stronger after the mistake than it would have been having never made it.
And you are correct. And in this case, I ended up being promoted and was chief operating officer in that organization. So it was years later, but yeah. And we had a number of those kinds of conversations through the years where, and he needed me to disagree with him constructively. And again, from a collaborative standpoint, in order for us to get the best outcomes.
And I do hope that somewhere in the book is that phrase, silence can be selfish. Because I think even just hearing it that way, because we've all been taught, I still say it to people sometimes, you're better off keeping it to yourself. Like, at least in the moment, like, you're better off, like, let's take a moment, let's think things through. Like, to your point, are we not seeing it the same way? Is there something we don't know or understand? Is there a better way to say it? But at some point, silence can really become selfish. And if we're depriving somebody else of the opportunity to make a different decision, that means we're depriving both of us the opportunity to achieve a different outcome. So that's
exactly.
Very, very important shift in perspective.
And on the flip side of that, because I know somebody's listening going, oh man, you don't know the situation I'm dealing with. And I really don't think I can say anything in this, or I've been ordered not to, or, you know, different circumstances, those things happen. And in chapter seven is called Say Goodbye, How to Know When It's Time to Quit a Conflict. And there are times where it is time to pack up and go and make a different choice. And so we want to acknowledge that. But if we have the conversation first, now we have that data. And we haven't deprived them of the opportunity to make a different choice, to share with us their perspective. Now we know. We're not guessing. There's almost never like massive harm that's going to come from that conversation. At the worst, we get data that tells us we really don't want to be here anymore.
Yeah. And it's, and more often than not, we probably get data that shifts our perspective. Maybe not all the way from I don't want to be here anymore, but at least gets us back to the middle of the spectrum on what's really happening here. It may be the silliest example, but one that I feel like applies. My son loves to draw and loves to color. Cool. And when he was going into kindergarten, he was coloring with markers, which meant that, yes, he was coloring more or less pretty much most of the time between the lines with markers, but it was also all over his hands and his pants and the desk and whatever else, right? So then he goes to kindergarten and it's crayons only. And so now he comes home and he's like, Mommy, Daddy, why can't I color with markers? I want to color with markers. I tell him I only have to use crayons. I can only use crayons. And of course, Gabe is our only child, so we've never been through this before. And we don't have friends who we've had conversations about what happens when your kid starts kindergarten. Right? So this is all new territory for us. So of course, us. We're like, you're not going to let our kid color with markers?
What, we got this.
Can't handle markers? You think he's got to use crayons? This is insulting. Now, thankfully, we didn't say anything to the teachers, but this is our like conversation after Gabe goes to bed, right? What kind of teacher won't let our kid use markers? He's fully capable of using markers. And then at some point, whatever, like 2 or 3 months in the kindergarten, they send home like a packet of what they're working on and why and the different skills they're developing. And in there, it talks about how using crayons forces them to grip the crayons tighter and helps develop more fine motor skills and concentration when they're using crayons as opposed to markers or anything else. And we read that and we look at each other and we're like, oh.
Good thing we didn't go in all fired up.
Yeah. Glad we kept that one to ourselves. Glad we decided that wasn't a hill worth dying on because
it, but. Let's go back to what you said earlier. What if you had, putting on your sure. powerful phrases hat, and gone in and said, you know, hey, kindergarten teacher, curious, the thing about using crayons as opposed to markers, I'm curious about that. What's going on there? How's that look from your perspective? Oh, and here's why. Yeah, fine motor skills. Boom. And now we got information. You're not staying up all night angry at the teacher. Like, you know, I know we're exaggerating the situation, yeah. but it's a perfect example, right, for all of us about the opportunities.
Yeah, and you're right about, and I do really like, I wrote it down, that has this look from your perspective question, and I love how you keep going back to it. So like from an observing standpoint, I know you live all of this, but that clearly is one of your go-tos. And like you said, in the very beginning of this conversation, it fits in so many contexts and so many situations, and it's worth it. For me, one of my go-tos is just please walk me through. And it could be please walk me through your process, your perspective, your goal. It could be please walk me through anything. But as soon as I say please walk me through, now they're probably giving me details, chronological order, goal, like all of these things that I can start taking the data in and then finding new opportunities to connect and establish the path forward. And I feel like those two questions line up very well.
Very much so. And I'm glad that it's coming up because it's one that I have been investing in that for myself. I'd say over the last year of the time that we've been from writing the book and working on all the, you know, press and marketing, everything else, but concurrent with all of that, we're always in process. We're always growing. That's one I have actively been trying to incorporate into my life over the last 18 months. So it's hopefully it continues to show up.
It does. So it's showing up now. When you sent me some materials prior to this with the book coming up, and I appreciate you giving me the peek. And one of the things that really caught my attention, because I feel like we're probably in line with this, but I just read one line. So I'm curious as to your perspective on this. How do you feel about I statements? I should have waited if you weren't drinking coffee, my apologies.
I statements. There is... How would I describe this? Is chapter 2 in the book where we're talking about I statements because, you know, people have, we call this whatabouts in the book. Like people immediately, oh, what about this? What about this? And like, oh, I've heard about I statements. Listen, I statements had their moment in history and were proposed for good reasons. And there's still this research and support behind the reason that I statements were a thing. So, you know, I statements are like, I'm not going to talk about, you and I are having a conflict and I'm not going to say, Michael, you're a jerk, right? I'm going to say, Michael, I'm experiencing this. And when we start with our own experience, we're opening the door to a more meaningful conversation. Okay. The research, we know that's there. In practice, however, the practice of I statements, people get all convoluted. So I can't say Michael's a jerk. Michael, I think you're a jerk. Well, that was an I statement. Okay, no, that's not the spirit of an I statement. Michael, I want to tell you that I think that I have experienced you as a jerk. There was three I's, right? You know, and so we get these convoluted things that just... So the problem with I statements is that in practice, they're very difficult for people to use effectively, and they become a joke, and they lower our effectiveness. What we're trying to focus on in that, and the, you know, what does an I statement do for you, if we get back to the powerful phrases, what it's trying to do for you is to focus on your experience. That I'm having this experience, that my experience of this situation has been a lot of frustration, inability to do this. So even when we're talking about like the dealing with overwhelm or saying no, you know, I'm describing my experience and my situation, that is the intent behind them. But that's why you're not going to find us talking about, hey, go for an I statement, because people get themselves all tripped up.
Agree completely. And this was the second time I can picture people going, yep, yep, yep. When you're saying, Mike, I think you're a jerk. Mike, I'm experiencing you as a jerk. Mike, yeah, that sounds about right. I can see that. But, and even with those I statements, you know, right now, what I'm experiencing is, or right now I feel like, there's very valid opportunities to say that, as you're saying, but it can also create unintentional division.
Right.
Well, Michael, right now I'm feeling very frustrated with what you're saying. Well, David, I'm not trying to frustrate you.
Exactly.
And here is our argument that here's our like argument within an argument. Like, we were already having a tough conversation, and now we're having a tough conversation about whether or not I'm trying to frustrate you. And by the way, we both just staked ourselves to positions that we can't win or lose. Like, no matter what I do, I will never convince you I'm not trying to frustrate you. And no matter what I do, you'll never convince me that you're not feeling frustrated unnecessarily. So instead, if we can focus on, yes, as we work through this and I'm feeling so frustrated in the moment, it's important too. So I can still illustrate that I'm feeling frustrated, but without necessarily pinning it, now we have a chance to work through it together.
Yeah, it's my experience as opposed to anything you're doing. Yeah. And Yeah, it's one of those techniques that was very well intentioned, totally understand where it's coming from, but the practice of it just gets so convoluted.
Yeah. It was great on paper and sometimes works well, but then there's another large swath of time where there's more pragmatic and productive alternatives. We've been going at this for about an hour, and I could quiz you on this book in these phrases all day long, and it probably won't stop, because once I read the book, I'm sure there'll be emails and conversations going back and forth. I'm really excited for it. So to help wrap this conversation up, because I really do appreciate all of your time today, for people who are interested, first, in getting the book next week when it comes out, where do they go? And second, when they're like, wow, this is really powerful, where do I go get more of David and Karen's work? Where do they go?
Yeah, for sure. So the book's available everywhere. It's on Audible, on the e-reader platforms, hard copy, paperback, if that's your preference. So you can get it whatever way works for you, wherever you like to do that. Would say that if you go to our website, the easiest path to get to the book page is you can put in a conflictphrases.com as your URL, conflictphrases.com. And if you go there, we've got a whole resource center. And in there, you will find on May 14th, when the book goes live, you will find a Courage Collaboratory walkthrough guide, a book group guide. It's like 33 pages that you can use to read this book with a team. And so you can get a copy for your whole team and walk through it together, because, you know, what could be more powerful than everybody having the same set of vocabulary and tools? And there are scenarios and there's role plays and things to do to have fun with it. So there's a lot of different resources there for you. And if you love the goats, you might even find a goat on a stick and you can share your own powerful phrases, because we're not stopping with the 301 in the book. We want to keep collecting them and getting more. So we'll have to put in Michael's walk me through. That'll be making the list here in the add-ons.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And I certainly recommend, from the short preview I've had so far, get the book when it comes out, dive into it. And I like something that you said earlier too, tweak some of the verbiage so it fits you and it fits the situation. It's when we're teaching communication, it's not always say it like this. Everybody has their own vernacular, their own personality, their own cultural or contextual application. So tweak it so it fits you when you apply it.
100%. You got to make it your own. And you even heard me doing that as we were sharing them. I'm like, here's how it's written. Here's how I might use it in conversation.
Well, fantastic. And I made a mistake at the start of this conversation that I need to make right now, because I want to make sure that you and Karen get the public acknowledgement for the trip you were just on, whether people realize it or not. She just came back from the Philippines.
We did. Yeah.
And you were out there working, but the revenue that you raised for the work that you did was then turned around and donated back to orphanages and other causes for the people where you were, to help not only leave the place, but the people, and perhaps, in my opinion, most importantly, the children, in a better situation than before you got there. So I wanted to publicly congratulate you for that and thank you for that, and make sure that everybody knows that on top of this great work that you're doing to help us all with our conversations, you and Karen's commitment goes far beyond that. So thank you very much for all you're doing to make the world a better place.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Michael. Yeah, it's important for us that part of our give back to the world is we build a clean water well in Cambodia, and in honor of every client we work with. And so we've got 150 plus of those in the ground. And, you know, just the impact that clean water makes for people is so important. And so this was another, with some partner organizations, another chance to support women and families and children, and as well as do some really meaningful work and share that human-centered leadership and those practices. And yeah, a few powerful phrases along the way.
No doubt. So thank you very much. I'm grateful for your time, grateful for your insight, the 2 pages of notes I just took listening to this conversation. I'm excited for the book, and I'm excited to keep our conversations going. Thank you very much for your time today.
Appreciate you, Michael. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. We'll see you soon. David, thank you so much for another wonderful, insightful, and impactful conversation. It was great not just to hear about the study itself, but to learn more about the context, the issues that people talked about, what they learned, the alternatives, and yes, to hear more about the very specific phrases and scenarios and some of the frameworks that you have in place in order to give people the guides necessary to successfully navigate these conflicting conversations, which, as you mentioned in our conversation, are necessary for us to learn and grow as leaders, as individuals, and our organizations as well. And you said several things in there that are going to stick with me. Fantastic. I love the differentiation by asking somebody, what would success do for you, as opposed to what does success look like? I thought that was a great tweak. I also like the question, how does this look from your perspective? I thought that was another great one to ask as well. What a thought. Silence can be selfish. Sure, there's times where it's appropriate, but it can rob the people of making a better decision and us the opportunity to achieve a better outcome. I really like that one. And yes, in some contextual circumstances, no is absolutely a complete sentence. And that's all that should ever need to be said in those situations. Thank you very much, David, not just for the conversation, but for all the research and all the work that went behind it. I'm excited to read the new book. Thank you for everything you do. Keep up the great work. And of course, for everybody that took the time to listen to us today, thank you so much for continuing to carve out the time and join us. I hope you took several pages worth of notes and are ready to pursue some of these conversations differently. And hopefully you have that book earmarked for purchase next week as well. Thank you so much for being here. And before we go, let's thank our sponsors on the way out. Humantel. Head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training for recognizing shifts in facial expressions and nonverbal behavior that will tell you what people are most likely thinking or feeling at any moment in time, and then allow you to adjust your conversation and approach as necessary. That's over at humantel.com, the code's INCUASIVE25. For all the professional interviewers listening, if you haven't already, please head over to the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can learn more about membership in the organization, the training training, the support, the research, the networking that's available to you. It's also where you can learn about the certified forensic interviewer designation. Do you qualify? What does it take to pass the exam? And then what opportunities will you have ready for you post-exam once you pass? And of course, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the customized programs we are asked to facilitate to teach our clients how to obtain the everyday confession by connecting with their audiences on a level they previously haven't, elevating the questions that they ask, enhancing their observation and persuasion techniques, and encouraging people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. So please check out our sponsors. Thank you so much for being here. David, thank you again for a great conversation. Please, when you get a moment, like the show, share the show, comment, give us your feedback. Please subscribe. We would appreciate it. That way you know who the next guest is going to be and when the next episode is coming up. We appreciate you continuing to come back. Thank you all so very much. Stay safe. Take care of each other. We'll see you next time.